our class? Or
Pacific University Occupational Therapy students.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. I saw that. I believed you were a little older than high school students, although sometimes I get fooled once in a while in my advanced age.
Forget times you made when I teach.
We welcome you here today and hope it won't be too boring for you. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 646.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 646 had hearings on March 17th and April 23rd. The printed bill makes physician assistants agents of supervising the licensee when performing practice-related activities. However, at the last hearing, we discussed the Dash 1 amendment, which replaced the original bill and reinstated the mandate that insurers cannot refuse claims for the sole reason that they were submitted by a physician assistant. At that time, we also discussed possibly removing the provision that mandate would have to come up for a review in 6 years, and therefore we printed the Dash 2 amendment, which accomplishes that goal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. I call Kurt Hawkinson. Go right ahead, Kurt.
Thank you, Senator Fisher and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Hawkinson. I'm a physician assistant practicing here in Salem. I am the immediate past president of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. As the clerk noted, we're here to talk about Senate Bill 646. And as you recall, 1 week ago in here, Senator Burdick asked why we were still continuing with the sunset clause on this. At that point, we supported removing the sunset clause. Since then, with a conversation of representatives in the insurance industry, we are coming back and supporting the Dash 1 amendments with some hope that between now and perhaps next session or the expiration of a six-year sunset clause, we've come up with a process to evaluate this along with some similar statutes on a regular basis. It would be something that would be a little more agreeable to everyone. Not that we have trouble with the substance, it's just that this comes up every 6 years and sometimes sort of surprises us, and therefore we have to amend bills such as the one before you. With that really ends my testimony. I think you're familiar with this bill from a week ago, and I'd be happy to take your questions if you have any.
To make sure that I've got everything straight, to we're going to go back to the Dash 1 and then disregard the Dash 2, which would have removed the sunset.
Senator Fisher, yes, you are correct. We are supporting the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. Are there further questions, Mr. Hawkins? Oh, Peggy Annett? I'm sorry. You blended right in with the crowd. That sweater and the... You look just like a schoolgirl.
Thank you. It's been a long time, Senator Fisher.
Shame on you. Now the sweater matches her face.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and yes, I did have a conversation with representatives for the physician assistants and have no problem with the substance of the bill, but as a number of you have heard me previously testify, I think that it's appropriate for us to review how we review mandates, and that's one of the things that I'm looking at working on during the interim. And with that, they agreed to go with a six-year review, and it's similar to what we've done with the emergency room services. And so it's, again, it's a process issue, not a substance issue.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And apologize for not having seen you come up. Okay, further questions? None. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
And I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 646 and open a work session on Senate Bill 646.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 640. I would move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 646.
Senator Morissette moves that we accept the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 646. Further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, will clerk call the roll?
Senator Brown. Senator Burdick.
Aye.
Senator Pardo.
Aye.
Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Moore says.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 646 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morissette moves Senate Bill 646 to the Senate floor with a due, as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? Will the clerk call roll?
Mr. Brown? Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Cardo?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. And Senator Brown is excused. The motion carries. Do we have a carrier?
I would.
Senator Morissette will carry Senate Bill 646. Close the work session on Senate Bill 646 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 885.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 885 had its first public hearing on the 16th of April. It requires written consent prior to an autopsy not relating to the death requiring an investigation. We had two amendments drafted based on our initial public hearing. The dash one amendment would allow a person to grant consent for an autopsy via fax or by phone. The dash two allows a person to grant consent for an autopsy via fax. Ann Cruzen is available to answer questions if you have them. But I know that she also probably stopped by your office with letters related to her preference for fax communication.
So we have a dash two. Okay, Ann Cruzen, would you come forward, please? Go right ahead. And we appreciate you taking the time to come back down again.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator Fisher, Chair and member of the committee. I do have in front of me here the letter that I had dropped off at everybody's offices. With our response to OHSU's proposal for an amendment, and we would be interested to see a fax attached to this bill, but are not interested in the telephone only. We see that is open to a lot of different problems. Part of the reason why we were looking at having this bill sponsored was because of the miscommunication that was told to us that was the reasons why our problems had occurred in the first place. I do have here with me a list and a letter from one of the directors of OHSU explaining and apologizing for their misunderstanding of the situation. So I do have several letters, as a matter of fact, that do back up the importance of the communication. And I feel that a telephone verification or autopsy consent would just be open for additional problems.
Any further questions? Well, it, in a way, it was a bit, how should I put it, confusing to me, too, mm-hmm. with the hospital or the initiating agency having two people witness and the person phoning and the other end of the phone giving permission only having themselves.
Well, it
didn't seem to me to be exactly a fair situation where, again, if two people were looking at it from a different way, from a entity as against the one person that would said, you know, I didn't, and two of them coming in and saying, yes, you did. And so I understand your concern about it, and that was a little bit my concern, but I couldn't figure out how we could get two people on the same phone line easily either, you know, so that the person that was phoning in would have somebody that was fully cognizant of the conversation. So
yes.
I basically am in sympathy with your request here.
Yes, Senator Fisher, I agree, because I was thinking what would be the rush on something like this as giving an autopsy consent? You would not be able to retract it as you would any other business agreement in that sense. So I would think that if there was some hurry that they might want to postpone giving consent until they did have an option of having the actual form to go over and clarify any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burdick.
When you say make reference to written consent on a standardized form via fax or other documented means, not everybody has access to a fax, or, you know, that might be a logistical problem for some people. Not everybody has email either, but would email suffice as another documented means?
With my understanding of how the process worked, I would recommend that the person that's being requested of be able to have the same benefit that somebody who were at the site of the facility, which would mean that they should be able to visually see how things are noted down. I understand what you mean about not being able to have access to a fax or an email, but given the circumstances and the situation, I would think that would warrant waiting until those papers were able to be delivered for review.
But Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'm trying to see if email would work. Like, they could email the form, maybe with a form number on it, and then the person could read the form and say, you know, I've read form XYZ, and I give my approval for this autopsy. Would that fit within what you're trying to accomplish here?
Yes, it does say that in other electronic transmission. I would believe email would fit within that. The last sentence. Again, there was a lot of confusion I felt during the depositions that we had with the different doctors. The pathologist asked us for our definition of what we thought autopsy meant. And I found that disturbing because, in our view, an autopsy is to determine cause of death. But I found that in this other situation, it actually has as much priority, if not more, for study availability. So the reference that the hospital had made that autopsies are conducted for free is because it is of benefit to the school. And I believe the autopsy rate is, consent rate is declining. I feel that people should have informed consent. They should know if they are truly comfortable with donating and giving tissue or giving information, that is fine. But they should not be misled or have any misinterpretation. In our situation with our consent form that we refused, it was turned around on the very next form as we had no objections. So again, I feel that would be even more confusing over the phone. So
okay, any further questions? Does anyone else wish to speak further to the amendments? Seeing no one, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate you coming back down here and giving us your benefit of the, giving us the benefit of your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 885. Excuse me. And open a work session on Senate Bill 885.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 885.
Senator Brown moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 885. Further discussion? Objection? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Mr. Brown?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Florno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. It's carried.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brown.
I would move Senate Bill 885 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Brown moves Senate Bill 885 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
I actually would say I am extremely concerned about consent being given over the phone. I think that just in terms of evidentiary is not adequate. So I feel strongly that it needs to be in writing.
I feel the same way.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Florno?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morseth?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries. Yes, do we have a carrier?
Okay.
Senator Brown will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 885 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 865.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 865 has had several public hearings in April. As printed, it directs the Department of Human Services to seek a waiver to deny eligibility for medical assistance to otherwise eligible applicants receiving or eligible for health care services from Veterans Health Administration or from an employer-sponsored plan. However, we've discussed several amendments, and today we have the Dash 4 amendment, which would allow the Department of Human Services to establish an automated online provider payment submission system for the medical assistance programs, and it would also allow the department to establish a committee to assist and advise the department in obtaining that contract.
All right.
This currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
I've been working the last 2 days trying to figure out the proper route to get this bill over to the House to work on with the budget committee over in the House that's dealing with this, that's chaired by Representative Westland, and also has Representative Cruz on its membership. And there's several, how should I put it, several different opinions as to the proper method of getting it over there. I don't wish it to go down needing, because it still needs a couple of amendments possibly, and then they may want to restructure it to a certain extent to fit whatever plan comes out of for the Oregon Health Plan, whichever comes out of their committee. It's rather unusual to bypass the Ways and Means and go to the Senate floor and send a bill over there knowing full well that it's going to be recommended to be changed, and then have them send it to the Ways and Means Committee. If it goes to the Ways and Means Committee, from my understanding, it's difficult for them to amend it substantively. So that's kind of where we find ourselves in the predicament that we're in right now. And my intent, and I've tried to get across to all parties concerned, and it's taken them time to look at it, and Senator Schrader definitely wants to see it in Ways and Means. And my thought was that if it goes to the House and is amended, even if they didn't send it to Ways and Means, I wouldn't concur until it had gone to Ways and Means. And I don't know, and I guess I'm looking at the caucus leaders now to be thinking about this while we take a little bit of testimony on it here, and maybe you'll have a direction to guide me whether we want to go into a work session today or whether we want to hold it off until sometime when we have the next meeting, which I'm sure we'll have. Or whether we want to just put the Dash 4 amendments in it and send it to the House and ask to have the Ways and Means reference rescinded. So that's kind of a preface to our hearing here. So I would ask John Mangus and Tom Holt. Pardon?
John.
Oh, okay. This is not veterans related. It would be amended to where that is not veterans related. So, John, you wouldn't have to testify unless you want to, because it was very evident that what we had intended to do with this bill was not really designed in a way, or could be handled in a way that we could work that much with the veterans. And if we did something with the veterans, it would probably have to be in line of a pilot project, as was done in Multnomah County, or Washington County, excuse me, during the past interim. So it's no intention of ours to do anything basically here that would affect the veterans. So, Tom? Yeah. You can't be any more mixed up than I am.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacists Association. I just want to note for the record what appears to be an oversight in the Dash 4s. On page 2, there's kind of a laundry list of folks, stakeholders to include in an advisory group for the department, and pharmacy is not on that list. We suggest that be added because of the potential impact on the pharmacy claim system in this process. So, but we would certainly agree it's not a reason to hold up the Dash 4s. We could work on that on the House side.
All further questions? Tom, you may want to remain there a minute. I'll go into recess here briefly. Not everything is cut and dried in the legislative process, as you can see. Very often, bills that look to be and move on to Senate Bill 891 and hold a public hearing on Senate Bill 891.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 891 had its first public hearing last Wednesday, and it modifies the licensing qualifications for physical therapists and physical therapist assistants. At this time, we have the Dash 3 Amendment, which is quite extensive. In your packet, you do have a section-by-section analysis from Stephen Kafouri, and you also have testimony from the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon and the American Occupational Therapy Association.
Okay, and at this time I would call I would call Diana Godwin and Greg Thiessen. Go ahead, Greg. We can proceed now. Diana Country.
Chairman Fisher, Senators. For the record, my name is Greg Thielen. I'm a practicing occupational therapist and the current chair of the Occupational Therapy Licensing Board for the state of Oregon. I thank you for hearing my testimony today. I'm here in the representative capacity as the for the state licensing board. And I have I have some information for you.
All right. Diana, you can come right on up and be here. Do you have others there that you wish to bring? Did you have others that you wish to bring with you? Or
Stephen, I guess. All right. I'm here to assist the committee.
Okay. Go ahead, Greg. Oh, I apologize for the interruption.
No problem. Again, my testimony is in representation for the Occupational Therapy State Licensing Board. The State Licensing Board wishes to make several statements in regards to the proposed Senate bill. Since the State Licensing Boards are enacted to enforce the state licensing laws in order to protect the public health, safety, and welfare, it's the board's concern that the wording under the practice definition of physical therapy in 891 is broad and not necessarily specifically encompassing specifics related to physical therapy and how those relate to other health licensing and practicing boards in the state of Oregon. As you can review in the statute 675.210, which was provided under this the original definition provided in the original licensing law for occupational therapy, means analysis and use of purposeful activity with individuals who are limited by physical injury or illness, developmental learning disabilities, psychosocial dysfunction, the aging process in order to maximize independence, prevent disability, maintain health. Some of the other items that are there underlined, exercise to enhance functional performance. And we feel that the wording in the licensing law, specifically in the PT, will conflict with the PT proposed licensing changes for, as in Section 1.6, states alleviating impairments for functional limitations by designing, implementing, and modifying therapeutic interventions, reducing the risk of injury, impairment, functional limitation, and disability, including the promotion of maintenance of health, fitness, quality of life in all age populations. So again, why appreciating the association's need to clarify looking at scope of practice and having those types of things. The definitions seem to be unduly broad and would be very difficult for the public and for other individuals accessing services to actually define what scope of practice and how that interacts with the other licensing agencies in the state. In the original, before the amended section...
Now, are you referring to the original bill or to the Dash 3 amendments?
The amendments, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Generally, previously in the physical therapy licensing law and currently in the occupational therapy licensing law, there is a statement that is the last underlined section on the piece of paper I provided that states persons licensed under any other law of this state to do any acts included in this definition are excluded. And that's kind of been a standard statement license law to cover some of those times when some of the practices may overlap slightly. I know the Oregon Occupational Therapy Association has provided some a letter and providing some specific changes in wording. So that's it for my testimony at this time.
Mr. Chairman, Diana Godwin representing Independent Practice Physical Therapists. If I could assist in helping to clarify some of these issues with respect to the occupational therapist concern. First of all, I would point the committee to Section 8 of the bill, starting on page 8 of the Dash 3 amendments. Section 8 specifically repeats what has been in our current law and which is the accepted law in Oregon, which is that nothing in this bill, nothing in sections 1 to 17 of this 2003 Act restrict a person licensed under any other law of this state from engaging in a profession or practice for which that person is licensed, just provided that the person does not represent, imply, or claim that the person is a physical therapist. I would also point out that under our new definition in section 1, where there was concern raised that it deals with alleviating impairments, functional limitations, reducing risk of injury, impairment, functional limitation, that is currently what physical therapists do and, in fact, is currently reflected in our existing definition of physical therapy in 688.010 subsections 4. And subsection 4A talks about dealing with bodily malfunction, dealing with the evaluation of function of a human being. Physical therapists deal not only with musculoskeletal problems, or that we deal with musculoskeletal dysfunction, where we've got problems of range of motion of a shoulder that doesn't move very well. That is a bodily function of moving your joints, re-strengthening your knees after surgery. So yes, we definitely do deal with functional limitations of human beings. That is what physical therapy does and has always done and is currently in our current definition. But I do want to also say that we know that in Oregon, there's considerable overlap among licensed health practitioners, such as chiropractors, massage therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists, physiatrists, orthopedists. We do some of the same things. Many of us bill under the same what are called CPT codes, current procedural terminology codes. That's the five-digit code that everybody uses to bill a certain medical procedure. So a number of existing licensed groups do share some of those same scopes of practice. There's necessarily an overlap of practice, and that's why we were very careful in Section 8 of the Dash 3 amendments to clarify that nothing in this bill is intended in any way to restrict the practice of other licensed practitioners, including occupational therapists in this matter. And the Physical Therapist Licensing Board, I've worked with them for a number of years. I have no concerns whatever that licensing board will strictly enforce that a physical therapist does physical therapy and does not step outside the scope of their practice. They have considerable powers to discipline and restrict that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori, representing the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. I just wanted to make one general statement at this point, and that is this bill was very carefully drafted over a couple of years, and there are two major principles in the bill, among others, but two major ones. Number one is there is no change in the scope of practice of physical therapy. There may be some words changes, maybe clarifying changes, but there is nothing in this bill that allows a physical therapist to do anything that the physical therapist cannot do today. That's one major principle. Does not change what a physical therapist does. Secondly, we carefully drew this bill so that it does not change what anybody else does. There's nothing in this bill that has any impact whatsoever on the practice of any other licensed care practitioner in the state of Oregon. It has no effect on their practice.
Further questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Again, Diana Godwin. Last week, the committee raised a number of issues, and I just wanted very quickly to outline that the Dash 3 amendments, I believe, addressed every issue that the chair or members of the committee raised. Dash 3 amendments, very briefly, one of the small changes was we changed the name Oregon Physical Therapy Licensing Board back to its current term, Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board. We did that strictly for financial concerns. We just don't want to have the board even have to go to the expense of reprinting stationery. So that was one small amendment. The other one was the concern from the veterinarian. So we amended Section 9, our general scope of practice, our independent practice section.
Okay.
First lines of Section 9 on page 9, line 6, says, except as provided in ORS Chapter 686. That is the veterinarian licensing law. We put that in there to make it clear that if a physical therapist is going to be providing physical therapy on an animal, and we do that. There are some specialties that do that, with horses in particular. Dogs and cats have joint problems. That will be in conjunction with working with a veterinarian. And we worked with Chris Crane and Legislative Council to be sure that that language would cover that area. And I wanted to get on the record on behalf of the Veterinarians Association that by putting that in, puts that physical therapy practice under the supervision of a veterinarian. And so the physical therapist can work very closely with veterinarians, which is appropriate. And then the other small change, actually two changes, the chairman last week raised the concern about the licensing board giving itself the new authority to impose the costs of all proceedings, including attorney fees for any disciplinary proceedings. That was on page 12 of the Dash 2 amendments. That has been deleted. The licensing board agreed that they didn't need that extraordinary hammer. The other concern that was raised is the fact that under our current law, a a motor vehicle accident, a motor vehicle insurer does not have to provide what we call PIP coverage, personal injury protection coverage, for physical therapy unless it's pursuant to referral. That had been taken out, and in the Dash 3 amendments, that is put back in Section 16 on page 16, saying notwithstanding any other provision, personal injury protection benefits are not required to be paid for physical therapy unless the person is referred by a doctor, podiatrist, etc. So we wanted to make sure that the committee understood that all of those issues that were raised last week have been addressed in the Dash 3 amendments.
Mr. Chair, Stephen Kafur again. I wanted to make one thing clear and tell you a little bit that happened in the meantime between last meeting and this meeting, and that was the issue was raised by the veterinarians about the, who has authority over animals, and we wanted to make it very clear that veterinarians have authority over animals. We had that Section 9 amended. The question was raised by the veterinarians' lobbyist whether that amendment was sufficient for the whole bill and not for just that section, so that we want to make sure that totally in the whole act, the whole licensing act for physical therapists, the stricture that a physical therapist must operate under the licensing act of the veterinarians is always going to be required. And I talked to Chris Crane again about that, and he said that statement very flatly to me, that this one, the placement in the bill where it is means that no place in the practice of physical therapy, no place in this statute, can a physical therapist operate without the Practice Act of Veterinarians come into force first. And I told the lobbyist that I would try and have Chris Crane here to make that statement in front of the committee. Unfortunately, he's in a meeting right now, and so I apologize for not being able to follow through on that commitment. And I want to make sure that the committee understood that, and I would told the lobbyist I would get a written statement from Mr. Crane that could be read on the floor when the bill is carried on the floor, okay, to that effect.
All right. Thank you very much. I have Scott Gallant and Jim Anderson.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I just handed Ms. Godwin and Mr. Kafuri copies of letters we recently received from the Oregon Occupational Therapy Association, and we want them to respond to those concerns. I assume someone's here from that association to testify. So,
Let's see.
We come back.
Thank yes, you. We do have. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. I guess I'm a little overwhelmed in the sense of this bill is a significant, in our opinion, in my council's opinion, significant change.
Now, we are dealing with the Dash 3 amendment.
Dash 3 amendment. Good. Significant change from the current statutory authority for the practice of physical therapy as we read the amendments. The change in the definitional provisions of the definition of physical therapy goes, in our opinion, well beyond the current statutory provisions, and in fact does vest authority, extensive authority, with the Board of Physical Therapy to expand the scope of practice of physical therapists. There are key changes in the Dash 3 Amendment definitions. For example, developmental impairments, the examining and treatment of other health and movement related conditions.
Scott,
the diagnosis.
Can we give a page, please, or a section?
Page 2, lines beginning at the top of the page, lines 1 through, and goes on down, obviously, to line 12. But I'm referring specifically to the new definition of physical therapy. The diagnosis, prognosis, planned intervention, and the assessment of ongoing effects of and therapeutic intervention. In the current statute of the definition of physical therapy, which you may find, to make it easier for some committee members, 688.010, subsection 4, subsections 4 and subsection 4A, the definition of physical therapy is the evaluation and treatment and instruction of a human being to assess, prevent, correct, and alleviate and limit the signs and symptoms of physical disability, bodily malfunction, and pain. That is quite different than the definition that you have in front of you in the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 3 amendments also provide on page 5 and page 6 for an exception for potential licensees who have been educated outside of the United States in providing satisfactory evidence of the applicant's education is substantially equivalent to the requirements required of all other licensees. It exempts the provision of any written proof that the educational authority in the applicant's country of origin recognizes the applicant's school of physical therapy and that they must submit educational credentials evaluated by credential evaluation agency recognized by the board. That is exempted on page 6, subsection 4, and I'm not quite sure why the board would make that recommendation, but I'm sure that they can go through that in detail. Section 6 of the bill does elucidate some indication of what type of training physical therapists in subsection 2 will be required to participate in. I'm assuming that this would be for newly licensed physical therapists as opposed to those who are currently been trained and educated under previous standards, including, again, the diagnosis and prognosis of what essentially I assume are medical conditions, but the legislation is not clear on that, and there is no real definitive delineation of any limits under the provisions, new provisions of the Dash 3 amendments. While it may be true that the Dash 3 amendments provide for not restricting any other licensed person under Section 8 of the bill on page 8, the legislation goes on to restrict and prohibit the ability of others to bill for physical therapy services, any business entity or individual, which would include physicians, I presume, for the provision of those services. And it goes on to say that if there is a violation of this section, Section 10 of the bill, page 9 and 10, that the Board of Physical Therapy or whatever the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board may subject non-licensees to their jurisdiction, I assume, for penalties or some kind of fines. I am not aware of any other statute, that of a licensing entity that has disciplinary or, I assume, monetary penalties, for example, against licensees of the Board of Medical Examiners. And I would, of course, suggest that the committee might want to clarify the extent of this prohibition on billing and the ability to indicate, apparently by this section, that an orthopedist or certainly well-qualified physician may have a subspecialty that includes physical medicine or sports medicine, which may include physical therapy, but I'm sure that can be clarified by the proponents of the bill as well. That would be...
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
So, Scott, what happens when someone's out there practicing medicine, like acting as a doctor, that isn't really that person isn't trained as a doctor? Who is responsible for disciplining that person?
For those who are practicing without a license, mm-hmm. it's the Board of Medical Examiners.
Okay, so you're concerned.
And probably the district attorney as well. You're correct.
Okay.
There are no, as far as I know, there are no other licensing statutes for other practitioners that extend or attempt to extend their disciplinary authority to licensees of the Board of Medical Examiners in current law that I'm aware of.
That, Scott, that wouldn't rule out the fact that another board could make a complaint.
Mr. Chairman, they most certainly could, and the Board of Medical Examiners would obviously, if it was a complaint with substance, would act on that. But as I read this bill, in this particular section, this extends authority, the Board of Physical Therapists, authority over the practice of physicians, as I currently read it. If you look at page 11, lines 6 through 9, which is regarding grounds for disciplinary action, subsection 8 is very curious. Because I believe, as it's currently written, it implies that physical therapists would have the authority to use controlled substances under this section if the licensee did not use medications in a manner dangerous or injurious to the licensee or others to an extent or in a manner that such use impairs the licensee's ability to practice safely or to the extent or in a manner that is illegal. I think this section implies that one could argue, and I am arguing, that if a physical therapist used prescriptive medication that in their view was not dangerous for their client, that it would be legal to do so. And I think this section should be clarified as well.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, Legislative Council wrote this, but I assume what this section is doing is giving the board authority to discipline their members who are using drugs illegally, because there's been a huge problem out there with other boards who can't discipline their members when they are using illegal drugs. So I think that's what this section is trying to get at. I could be totally wrong, but I'm sure Legislative Council would be happy to come clarify that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I appreciate the clarification. And I would also like to clarify that the Board of Medical Examiners is one of the most aggressive licensing boards in the country. There are two different issues between the illicit use of medications and the authorized use of prescriptive medications within the scope of practice. The intent of this section may be for the purpose of authorizing the Board of Physical Therapy to discipline their members for the use of prescriptive medications, but one could read this section as I just did, and I think the committee should clarify this section of the bill if you're going to seriously consider this legislation. Mr. Chairman, those are all of the specific portions of the Dash 3 amendments that I believe need very serious work before the committee would consider moving this legislation. I simply, and the Medical Association, our council, simply disagrees that this bill does not change the scope of practice. In our opinion, it does, and it is substantial. I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson here today for the Oregon Association of Orthopedists. Scott gave the specifics of the bill. I will be brief and try to give some general viewpoints from our perspective. First of all, I'd like to say that the orthopedists of this state work hand-in-hand with the physical therapists, and it's an association that we've long enjoyed and continue to into the future. However, at this point on the Dash 3 amendments, we would have to oppose them at this time for some reasons that I'll outline here. First of all, it's a very involved issue that we address late in the session, and it comes to us as a gut and stuff rather than a comprehensive bill of its own, standalone bill, and something that probably should have been addressed. If they've known about it 2 years, as Mr. Kafouri has said, we should have seen this or something in a draft form during the interim. It would have helped us at this point in time. And actually, we would like to have and need more time to review this point by point. It does create an independent board, which is named in the Dash 3 amendments as the Oregon Physical Therapist Licensing Board, which has very, in our view, very broad authority and responsibilities. And it's particularly disturbing to us that the seven-member board has no physician. I think that to safeguard their position, if nothing else, physical therapists would invite a physician to be on the board. Relating issues to this bill, I would take you back very quickly, something that you members haven't heard, but last session, House Bill 3120 came before the House Human Services Committee. This bill dealt with direct access, meaning that a layperson off the street can go directly to a physical therapist without being referred by a physician. This is something the law changed several years ago to allow this to happen, and the physician community, I believe, at that time was helpful to the physical therapist to try to get this direct access. Senator Morissette, I beg your pardon. You were sitting on the committee last session, so you do remember the wrangling that we went through. But it was a decision of the committee to allow for a referral to a physician, which is presently in law. The present law says 30 days treatment by a physical therapist, then they must refer to a physician. We had allowed in that bill that it be expanded to 60 days. The physical therapist wanted to take that referral off completely. And I would point out to you on page 1, line 5 of the bill, is repealing ORS 688.132 and .134. These were the two sections of law contained in House Bill 3120 of the 2001 session.
What was that number again, Jim?
It's on line 5, Mr. Chair, ORS 688132 and 134. That gives the physical therapist direct access and also states in that section of law the necessity to refer that patient to a physician if no improvement is seen over a 30-day period. We believe that the board action now could allow them, the board's own action could now allow them under page 3, lines 24 through 27 of the Dash 3 amendments. By the board's own action, they could accept and institute direct access again, since it has been repealed or would be repealed by the passage of this bill if you adopt the Dash 3 amendments. And by the board's own action, they could decide not to refer a patient to a physician. Just food for thought, and it's something that caught our attention very quickly. I will leave it there, Mr. Chair, and I'm sure Mr. Gallant and myself, we would be open to questions if the committee had any at this time.
Okay, questions from the board? Would you be willing to work to find some kind of satisfactory compromise amendments?
Mr. Chairman?
I don't mind putting you on the spot, you understand.
This never slowed you down before, Mr. Chairman. The Medical Association certainly would be willing to talk to the proponents to see if there are portions of this legislation that might be workable. I am not confident that we would be able to craft a complete rewrite of the physical therapy statute in the breadth that these amendments propose. I think it's just very difficult to do given the time frame that you have and that we actually have in trying to
deal with the time frame we have.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, committees are working their way into the close it down process, and I think it's probably coming sooner than later. And I'm not trying to dance on this, but it is very difficult given the process by which this legislation has been introduced. In the breadth of it, to say that we would be able to do a complete rewrite that met all of our needs in some kind of compromise.
Yeah, we found out Monday that there had been no collaboration or any work with the other groups on this particular bill, and so that's why I was initiating my question just to determine in my own mind whether to say go back and work on this through the interim and get the thing under wraps for the next session and go from there, or whether to try to take a chance on the fact that if we were here a little longer, maybe some of us would hope that we might be able to get something done here yet this session.
Mr. Chairman, most certainly it would have been preferable to have maybe been involved in this in an earlier phase. Clearly, we were not. It's not an obligation, obviously, by proponents of legislation to do that. But it might have maybe made the process a little less frustrating for you and the committee members, and most certainly for the Medical Association, maybe others who have really more or less learned of the extent of the proposed changes fairly recently.
Well, it certainly didn't come to us timely, because I actually had to request permission to hear it with special permission from the Senate President, because basically it came into our hands after the time that we were normally dealing with Senate bills. So,
Mr. Chairman, I would make one other observation, if I may. I don't know of any state of emergency that this bill requires immediate consideration or passage this session. To my knowledge, I mean, there may be some emergency need for this, but I don't know of one. So I think there is, in fact, time for maybe more timely consideration of the implications of the proposal. It might be a more wise choice rather than rushing something through.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Karen Van Antwerp and Peggy Annett.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Karen Van Antwerp. I'm a practicing occupational therapist in Oregon, and I'm presenting on behalf of the OT Association of Oregon, and I would like to testify on Senate Bill 891, and I am going to just go through the document that you've been provided.
And that is the Dash 3 amendment again.
Correct.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Before she gets started, could you tell me the difference between an occupational therapist and a physical therapist?
Maybe you could just confine yourself to what an occupational therapist is.
That might be better. Thanks. That was probably better said. Thank you.
I actually addressed that a little bit in the document that I have here. I think if I can get partway through and then maybe readdress that, is that acceptable? Okay.
Except, Mr. Chair, I actually need a copy of the document because I gave mine to someone else. So.
Oh. Okay. We got an extra copy. Thank you. I will share mine with staff. Okay.
The Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon, which represents over 300 occupational therapy practitioners in Oregon, including OTs and OT assistants, encourages you to oppose the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 891 unless the amendments are revised to address concerns raised by the occupational therapy community. As introduced, Senate Bill 891 seeks to modify licensing qualifications for physical therapists and physical therapy assistants. Proposed amendments to Senate Bill 891 seek to make additional changes to the physical therapy law, including a new definition for practice of physical therapy. OTAO has serious concerns about the proposed new definition, the applicability of the physical therapy law, and the provisions related to billing for physical therapy. Concerning the proposed definition of practice of physical therapy, OTAO believes that it's important to clarify the distinct role of each profession in stating practice acts. A profession's domain or scope of practice is based on the components of the scope being included historically in educational preparation and clinical application within the profession. OTAO is concerned that the proposed definition for practice of physical therapy is unclear in defining functional limitations. We are concerned that the definition does not sufficiently define the context in which physical therapy intervention addresses patient function and could encroach on the occupational therapy domain of practice. Occupational therapy practitioners are educated to address function as it relates to cognition, psychosocial, developmental, perceptual, and sensory motor issues to incorporate activities clients wish to do, are required to do, and are expected to do in their daily life. So hopefully that I can...
Mr. Chair, can you give me some practical examples of that?
I can. I'll use a simple example. For example, with a stroke patient, an occupational therapist, incorporating all those aspects of care may work on dressing or bathing or grooming, a more functional activity incorporating physical disability, cognitive disability, sensory motor deficits, and present that to the client in aspect of a functional activity. And so that is a distinct difference between physical therapy and occupational therapy from an occupational therapy practice act standpoint.
I believe it also could include feeding oneself, helping you feed oneself. I remember, and of course I've been out of this, it seems almost like since the Stone Age, but actually with a stroke victim, doing some simple tasks like stacking matchboxes and things like that where they have to try to continue to work with their motor skills and and progress on in the use of their limbs and so on, and hands. And it's interesting as you go down through the years to see how the specialties increase, because 35 years ago when you talked about occupational, you know, and we didn't call it occupational therapist, we just called it can't even think now what it just basically considered activities, and it was an activities director that eventually turned into an occupational therapist. And you kept them busy by making Reader's Digest Christmas trees and ice cream box, trash boxes, and something like that, bowling, you know, actually things to help pass the time.
Correct. Occupational therapy is often confused with vocational therapy, and we're often confused with those who might work in vocation, which occupational therapies do. The word occupation as a root for occupational therapy comes from the Greek word to do. And so the application of occupational therapy incorporates task analysis, daily activities, how people experience their occupational or activity role. And so it's much more broad in its practice compared, some may say, to physical therapy.
And it goes way on beyond the physical aspect of it into the mental remembering and tasks of knowing what date it is, where they're at, you know, the time of day, all kinds of things like that. Senator Birdie Kidd.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just want to, one of my very dearest friends happens to be an occupational therapist with a PhD, and they are extremely highly trained and much more specialized than I think your description would indicate. They are a really significant part of the medical team for someone who has those kind of disabilities. Mm-hmm. They do a great job.
Thank you. To continue here in my summary, OTAO believes that the proposed definition of practice of physical therapy must be amended to clarify physical therapy assessment and intervention as it relates to the term functional limitation. And in the proposed amendment, I can refer you to actually page 2, which has the specific definition of that they're proposing for functional limitation. And on page 2 of my document, I have a spot here where I've restated their proposal and requesting that they amend this proposal to include an insertion of their definition of functional limitations. We do agree that physical therapy does incorporate function into their practice, but because our practice acts is very specific to how we apply that function, our request is for that to be more specific in what they're choosing to put forward. So in three spots, in section A, B, and C, we've asked for an insertion of the functional definition. Our second issue is under proposed applicability of physical therapy law, and the OTAO is concerned that the proposed amendments strike section 688030. Under current law, the physical therapy law, ORS 688010 to 688220, does not apply to, and I can refer you to the page I'm on here, page 8. Section 1. Any person engaged in the domestic application of any act included in the definition of physical therapy, or any person licensed under any other health care licensing law of this state to do any such act, or to persons working under the direction of any such persons, if the person does not represent to anyone receiving services or the public that the person is a physical therapist. The proposed amendments to Senate Bill 891 state that the law does not restrict a person licensed under any other law of the state from engaging in a profession or practice for which that person is licensed, provided the person does not represent, imply, or claim that that person is a provider of physical therapy or engaged in the practice of physical therapy. While occupational therapists do not wish to provide physical therapy services, there are interventions that both professions use as a part of an occupational therapy or a physical therapy treatment plan. Limiting the use of these interventions to only licensed physical therapists could restrict the practice of occupational therapy and other health professions in Oregon. The OTAO suggests that provisions from the existing law be integrated into the proposed amendments. And again, on the, I guess it's the third page of my handout, the OTAO has applied their suggested changes to Section 8 by deleting, through that bold strikeout section there, that the person, that it would state that this 2003 Act did not restrict a person licensed under any other health care licensing law of this state to do any such act or to persons working under the direction of any such person if the person does not represent to anyone receiving services or to the public that the person is a physical therapist.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Brown.
Back to sort of the differences between.
Uh-huh.
And I'm reading your statutory definition. It's like a quarter of a paragraph. I mean, it's extremely lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say that some of the things you do with your clients, physical therapists would also do with their clients? Is there any overlap?
There is some overlap, yes.
Okay. Does the overlap go both ways? For example, the physical therapists do some things that occupational therapists do and the other way around? Or does it only overlap one way in the sense that physical therapists do some things that occupational therapists do, but occupational mm-hmm. therapists don't do anything mm-hmm. that physical therapists do?
Mm-hmm. Both disciplines and are to an extent required to assess and intervene based on global presentations of a patient. And so, for instance, for both physical therapy and occupational therapy, it is a fairly common practice for both to take a physical motor assessment as well as to say, okay, are there psychosocial issues here? Are there cognition issues here? And to gather that during an assessment time. But it is the occupational therapist who would incorporate those cognitive, psychological, psychosocial, developmental things into an application that would be different from physical therapy because of the fact that we are intervening around task and task analysis and activity, that it becomes more of a holistic approach that we do. It's not to say that those things aren't important to the physical therapist or they're not aware or demonstrating responses to those things. It's just that occupational therapy by practice does incorporate that more into what they ultimately provide to the patient.
Mm-hmm. I would also hazard a guess that sometimes yours are oriented toward the occupational things of just living.
Correct.
Yeah, and getting around where probably many of your clients do not have access to physical therapy, would not be actually allowed physical therapy for some of those things, and yet technically you're keeping them with their fingers limber and
what do those?
It is possible for
to service their daily needs.
It is possible for one or the other discipline to be appropriate for a patient or both to be appropriate for a patient at any one time. Depending on what the patient's goals are, where they're at in their recovery, they may be in at different times and be involved at different times or the same time.
Okay, we kind of need to proceed on. Have you got more here yet to?
This last section here, I won't go through in as much detail. I guess if you'd like to skip forward to my final page, which talks about the use of, I guess it refers to Section 10 and the billing of CPT codes. The OT Association suggests this language be stricken. Because it does imply that the CPT codes are limited to physical therapy. And so the sentence that's struck out here is a suggestion from OTAO that this includes the billing of services labeled as physical therapy unless such services are provided by or under the direction of a physical therapist licensed pursuant to Sections 1 to 17 of this Act. That sentence there implies that physical therapy can only use certain defined CPT codes. And CPT codes are mutually shared amongst healthcare professionals. The Occupational Therapy Association has an act that I referred to here, the OT Uniform Terminology for Occupational Therapy, third edition. We use that as the way for how those CPT codes translate into more specific documentation, but we don't want there to be an intent that that CPT codes would become not shared by all disciplines in the manner that they've been.
For the benefit of the committee that may not be current with what CPT means, that's a current procedural terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And it, I think, refers, you're referring to parts of Section 9700 of the CPT code.
Correct.
Section 10 on page 9.
I'm not sure of all the exact numbers, but I believe it's in the 9700s. Of
correct, it is. It's the 9700 series. Right. But for an example, a code for therapeutic activity is a very broad code that can be used by multiple healthcare professionals, and then through the documentation in the medical record or the client's record, that's where you would find how that code was approached through intervention by the therapist.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Peggy.
Good afternoon, Chair Fisher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. I will try and be clear. I handed in a table, and I did this to try and sort out the same kind of issues I think that the committee is facing, and that is to try and distinguish between what's an existing statute and what's being proposed in order to clarify the scope of practice issues and some of the other issues. And my sense of it is that it is an expanded scope of practice for the physical therapist, and it creates a new freestanding type of practitioner under a new semi-autonomous board. One of the interesting elements in the board proposal that you heard about was that the board itself will be reconstituted absent a physician, as Mr. Anderson pointed out. But interestingly enough, the constitution of the new board does not, although the members would be appointed by the governor, they are not subject to Senate confirmation in terms of the way that the Dash 3 amendments are presently written. That's just an observation. Another thing in terms of the scope of the bill, it actually creates another category of physical therapy professional, which I don't think has been discussed. It's difficult to tell whether or not, well, it doesn't say that that person has to be licensed, but at least it does create a new category. In terms of trying to clarify between what a physical therapist does versus other professionals in this area, just to make the issues less clear, and which is one of the biggest problems I have with the bill and trying to figure out who does what under what circumstances. The current definition of physical therapy, for example, says that physical therapy does not include chiropractic as defined in its appropriate statute, and then goes on to identify what physical therapy does include. That language is deleted in the Dash 3 amendments. The other thing that is interesting, though, in the Dash 3 amendments, and that is on page 27, section 25, in lines 19 through 21, it turns out that a chiropractic physician now can do physical therapy types of services. Those responsibilities are deleted in the Dash 3. So it seemed interesting to me, and I had a brief conversation. I'm not sure what the consequence of it is, but what they have done, it seems, is to say that chiropractors can't do physical therapy, but then on the other hand, in the definition of what physical therapists can do, they've eliminated the prohibition for them to be able to do chiropractic services. Those are the kinds of issues I think that would need to be sorted out, and I can't tell you in my own mind what that means. Other key issues that come up, and you've heard quite a bit of about, is the issue of the freestanding professional. And the reason that it affects the interest of the insurance industry is because that transfers through to reimbursement questions. In essence, what I have done is that I've compared the existing language in ORS 688-132, which is the duty to refer to a physician or other professional, compared to what is proposed in the Dash 3 amendments. And you can clearly see when you look at that the referral by a physical therapist is only when the physical therapist deems that to be appropriate. And the specific conditions were when the services are beyond the scope of practice of a physical therapist or when physical therapy is contraindicated. However, there are no other caveats to that, with the exception of the fact that the physical therapist is to abide by ethical standards that are developed by the Physical Therapy Board. And it's interesting in that what has been culled out in my mind is a freestanding entity that makes its own determinations about an array of issues, which I think is what has generated a lot of concern, as you've heard from a wide range of people that have come to testify today. And with that, I will answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Joe Bell, Leonard Hagen, John Powell, and Mike Dewey.
I don't know. Peter was looking
here. That's right. Go ahead, gentlemen, ladies.
Mr. Chair.
Ladies first today.
I guess so.
Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jill Bell with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm only here to indicate that we have only had a very brief time to look at this, and there are only two issues that I want to bring to your attention. One is the issue that has been raised by several others on page 9 about the billing and about directing an investigation against the licensee regarding billing. That may be appropriate in some situations, in particular situations where the physical therapist is in an independent practice situation, but many physical therapists also work for hospitals, and they traditionally don't do the billing. So we would want to look at that language really closely to make sure that it doesn't have an adverse impact either on the hospital or on the licensee for something that they may or may not be doing. And the second piece is a couple of different places where it talks about confidentiality of records. Specifically, there was one on regarding subpoenas, and there was another section talking about HIPAA and then the consent form. And I'm here to tell you that I'm not the certifiably smart person on our staff on that issue, and I haven't had a chance for our legal counsel, Gwen Dayton, who we refer to her as the HIPAA queen, look through this. And I think that we would want to do that before
better
we
than
do
the HIPAA queen.
She's definitely not that. Queen. She hasn't had an opportunity to look at that, and I would really like to make sure that there's some areas where it seems to me that it conflicts, and she would be the person who would need to look at it, and we would want to do that before we would move forward with the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
just I don't know why I'm picking on you, except that is there a problem for folks that do people who are not physical therapists tend to use the words physical therapy? Is that more a problem in the physical therapy arena than, for example, for a doctor? I mean, I'm assuming there's a reason why this paragraph was drafted the way it is in terms of restricting and the billing provisions, et cetera. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I'm really not sure why it was drafted either, but I think the issue that I see is that not all practitioners have the option of working both in their own independent practices. I mean, there are physical therapy practices that are totally independent, and then there are also those who are work as employees of facilities. And I think that in itself creates some of the issue that we see.
Okay.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leonard Hagen, and I'm with Regents, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Our analysis, I received the -3 amendments on Monday, so our analysis is not complete, but based on what we've determined so far, we would oppose 891 or do oppose it because we believe it'll increase the cost of our benefits provided to members due to changes in the scope of practice. In addition to the practitioner terms of art as to the definition of scope of practice, definition of physical therapy that you've heard already, I'll point out again what Peggy briefly touched on, and that is in the current statute, the definition of physical therapy in ORS 688-010 or 010. There's a clause in there that says physical therapy does not include chiropractic as defined in ORS 684-010, and then it goes on to say what physical therapy includes. We believe that by removing that, you're in essence maybe adding back in, and I'm saying maybe adding back in chiropractic because that exclusion is no longer there, and we've heard there is some overlap in these definitions and terms. What that means to Regents, We currently exclude services rendered by chiropractors. Chiropractors are not on our list of providers unless the member, the group, wants to purchase a rider. So the benefit's available. It's on a purchase-by-rider basis. If under 891, physical therapists can render chiropractic services, we may have to pay for those services, thereby increasing benefits that we're not currently paying for. And as you've heard me testify in the past, Regents does oppose any bill that could increase the cost of benefits to our members. That concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Did you want to ask a question?
No.
Looked like you might want to.
No, no. Well, Mr. Chair, just for the record, chiropractic includes the employment and practice of physiotherapy, electrotherapy, hydrotherapy, and minor surgery. So just wanted to throw that out there. So,
ask you the definition of?
Physiotherapy.
Chiropractor.
Yeah, as a for a chiropractor. I assume that some of that is overlapping, I would presume.
Right. And on the chiropractic statute, one other thing that I think was mentioned that this bill does do is a chiropractic physician means somebody licensed under 684, which is a chiropractic, or 688, which is the physical therapy statute. That's removed in 891. So there's that issue as well that is raised by 891.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, and members of the committee, good afternoon. Mike Dewey, representing ODS Health Plans. We not only provide dental insurance, but medical coverage also, to make that clear. These are difficult issues for you, being in this building for a number of years. We understand scope of practice is very, very hard to get your hands around, and you're very smart people, but sometimes it's difficult to understand how all of this interaction takes place. Our concern is basically with the debate that has been held here today, and the proponents say it doesn't change very much, and then the opponents, the medical association and others, look at the verbiage and say, we think it expands the scope of practice. If it does, then we have to oppose the legislation with Regents and Blue Cross in the sense that it will increase utilization. Now, these are choices that you have to make. There are good choices, but nonetheless, if utilization goes up, rates go up. And that is not a good thing in the marketplace, in the current marketplace. And as rates go up, as you've heard this over and over again, we have more uninsured who had been insured. And that is not a good situation, and that is perhaps an unintended consequence of this legislation. For that reason, we have to oppose the legislation. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 891. Obviously, there's a manifold amount of work to be done on it yet, and I'll have some discussion with the proponents and see what we do from here. Later on, we have one more bill, Senate Bill 144. Public hearing on Senate Bill 144. My understanding is that there's some working relationships here. By the way, would welcome and hope this has been a rather instructive time for some of the future occupational therapists.
And for some of us, too.
You want to remember your definition of occupational therapy if you ever have to come to town.
Thank you to Senator Burgett, too.
All right. Yes, I'm going to have staff go ahead, and I did open the hearing.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 144 requires hospitals to record external cause of injury, poisoning, or adverse effect codes on hospital uniform billing forms and ambulatory surgery and inpatient discharge records.
Okay. We're a little limited on time, and I believe we still have a committee coming in here at 3 o'clock. We want to hurry, but I am under the understanding that there's a basically working relationship going on here, which I would like to encourage and recommend that continue on into the interim, quite probably. So Lisa Millett, Joanne is Fairchild, and
Chair Fisher, if I could ask to have Joe Bell come up.
Oh, sure, fine.
That'd be great.
Yeah, we'll. I'm not just sure who all's everybody. I'm just kind of going down the line here. And old trauma nurses. What's your name there? Go right ahead. Excuse me, hon.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Miette.
Handwriting.
Yeah.
Deciphering here. Probably good.
I'm Lisa Miette, and I manage the Injury Prevention and Epidemiology section at the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology and Health Services in the Department of Human Services. It's a mouthful. I'm here today to testify and ask your support on Senate Bill 144 and our efforts to have hospitals record external cause of injury coding on discharge records. I wanted to recognize the work that the Oregon Hospital Association has done with us since last April in exploring this concept. It's an important one, and there are a lot of details about the concept that might make it difficult for some hospitals to implement, and that's one of the reasons why we're interested in furthering our work together. I want to walk you through my testimony as briefly as possible. First, with some injury facts. Injury is the leading cause of death for persons in Oregon between the ages of 1 and 44. And in 2001, we had over 50,000 hospitalizations for injury at a cost of about $1 billion. I think it's over $1 billion. The science of injury prevention has demonstrated that we can prevent injuries by doing things like requiring kids to wear helmets when they skate and ride scooters. And we've been using some of our hospitalization data to evaluate the potential effectiveness of such a bill that was introduced by Senator Clarno and Senator Morissette. And we're hoping to use hospital discharge data also to evaluate the effectiveness if this bill should pass. We use it to evaluate the effectiveness of lots of public policy. We use it to evaluate the effectiveness of injury prevention programs and interventions that are introduced in communities in really wide variety of areas. Everything from traumatic brain injury to fall injuries to motor vehicle crash injuries to injuries due to intimate partner violence and sexual assault. We collect data on lots of different injury problems, and hospitalization data is a really important piece of the injury, what we call pyramid. If you think of an injury pyramid as something, the tip of the pyramid, the smallest part is the death data. The hospitalization data is the next big chunk. And in Oregon right now, our e-coding is only about 55%, and it's voluntary by hospitals. And just for your education, an e-coded code is an external cause of injury code that's added to the uniform billing code form. And what you've got in a Unicode billing code form is a group of diagnostic codes that say, well, this person has a fracture and, say, a cut. But without an E-code, you don't know whether that happened due to a fall or an inline skating accident or an incident where there was intimate partner violence and assault. So to evaluate your injury data in Oregon, you need the E-codes to know some of the circumstances around the injury to prevent them.
Most injuries when I was in the military occurred by somebody running into a door.
In Oregon, the leading cause of injury is motor vehicle crash, followed by firearms, and hospitalized injuries are falls, mostly in the elderly, as you know, Chair Fisher. So e-coding is not a new practice. One of the things that impedes our efforts to improve e-coding in Oregon is that the coding right now is voluntary. And we did a study over the last 2 years about e-coding. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gives us a grant to implement what we call core capacity surveillance. And our injury epidemiologist is here today, and she's evaluated the hospital discharge data and implemented a survey with the hospitals to explore and assess the barriers to e-coding. And with some hospitals, we really didn't find a lot of barriers, but we are concerned that with other hospitals, there are a number of barriers, and I can refer you to page 3 of my testimony. In the middle of that paragraph, it lists them. They may need to change internal policy. Some hospitals have a policy that they don't code at all. There's one hospital in the state that has no e-coding going on at all. Yeah. They may need to review coder training. They may need to review how staff document the cause of injury in the patient chart and or assess and resolve claim preparation issues. The big issue that we want to make sure does not impede e-coding in the state is that we resolve any claim preparation issues because we don't want to put hospitals at risk or jeopardize reimbursement for care. So these concerns have been resolved in 23 other states, though, that have mandated e-coding. The department believes that with additional support of maybe an implementation committee that includes members of the hospital association, ourselves, some insurers, that we could assure that any of the concerns that hospitals might have might be resolved without placing any undue burden on them. So in closing, we want to let you know that we think the law will ensure that Oregon has the critical tool it needs to do injury prevention in the state, and ask you to support the measure. Thanks a lot.
Actually, I would be very interested. We need to continue on with this. If there was evidence of the 23 other states that have done this, they've been doing it long enough to show that it's had any effect whatsoever on prevention. That would be a very interesting thing, because I think it's sometimes we already have had in Oregon, especially with the occupational OSHA or OSHA and that kind of thing, we've definitely shown, at least in workers' deaths and things like that, a definite decline.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morse.
I believe the state of Arizona has done some significant work in this area. I was served on this task force, and we heard from the state of Arizona the first meeting that we had, and I think that was a model.
Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Joe Bell with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And until I just heard Lisa give her title, I always thought mine was the longest in the Capitol building. I will refrain from using it today, however. One of the things in working with Lisa that we discovered was that the reasons that she mentioned just seemed to be the top level of the issue. And so we did a sort of an email and phone survey, and I specifically called the one particular hospital that she talked about that does show on the records of our data that we've collected that they have 100% non-submission of e-codes. They actually do the e-coding. And in talking with them, I found out the first thing that happens is that they're probably their major insurance company for the people that go to that particular facility, and it is a small facility, the insurance company does not want it. So what happens is that between where the coding is done in medical records and when the bill and that information gets referred out for data collection, that e-code is getting dropped off of the record. Another issue that came up with talking to the hospital that had the second lowest reporting was that in their system has it set up so that the first codes that are taken into account are the ICD-9 codes, and those are diagnostic codes that talk about whether or not they're treating somebody for a broken leg, a broken ankle, scratches, stitches, and all those different things for the treatment so that they get the billing done. Once a certain number of those are in there, and in severe traumas there would be a number of those, then the e-code drops off of their reporting forms as well. So one of the things that we're thinking is that a lot of in talking to most of the hospitals about this issue, they already think that e-coding is mandatory, which I find kind of amusing, and they're all doing it. The problems are that coding information is not then getting reported on the UB-92s, which is where we collect the data. So in talking with Lisa and the health services, we've decided that we need to probably attack this one facility at a time to find out what the issues are that are impeding the ability for the codes to be actually be reported as opposed to just being collected. And we also see some very beneficial uses for this information, one of those being we have a trauma system that is in dire need of funding, and if we could have more explicit data on what traumas there are out there and what the costs there are and what the types are, that maybe we would be able to address that issue using that data to get more funding for the trauma system as well. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead here with Bill Olson and Dr. James Lace.
Chair Fisher.
I'm sorry.
That's okay, and I'll be very brief. My name is Joanne Fairchild. I'm a trauma nurse coordinator responsible for injury and burn prevention at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital. I'm here on behalf of my work in injury prevention, both heading the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program and sitting on the Oregon Safe Kids Board. I'm asking for your support of external e-coding. We try to make our injury prevention as responsive as possible to what's going on in the state, but different parts of the state are different. We have people all across the state teaching our program, and we really, number one, rely on the data to let them know what the issues truly are so that we don't get sidetracked on something that the media picked up that's sensational but not really the biggest problem that our kids are facing. And then we also need the data to evaluate what our work is. And if we're only getting 55% of the data, that makes it very difficult for us. The other thing that I would like to do, I also brought written testimony from Dr. David Bliss, who is the medical director of pediatric trauma.
And I will enter that into the record.
Wonderful. And he's just asking for the same thing for the same reasons. Thank you very much.
Senator Fisher, for the record, my name is James Lace. I'm a pediatrician. I represent the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and Safe Kids Coalition of Oregon. 30 seconds. We're in favor of this bill. Anything that we can do to gather the data to look at and target prevention strategies to decrease the incidence of serious injuries in children, we're in favor of.
Okay. Thank you very much. And let's see, Bill Olson was... He's still here? Okay. Katie, you're not signed up here. Did you wish to kind of maybe summarize a little bit, or your Grant? I see Grant's obviously had to leave and go do some other things.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Liaison for Health Services in the Department of Human Services. And I just want to echo all of the comments from the previous speakers. We'd really like to see mandatory e-coding implemented and follow the lead of the 23 other states that are currently doing it. We appreciate the cooperation that we've been getting from the Hospital Association on working together to help us resolve this issue, and we're looking forward to working with them during the interim.
And we'll also enter Bill Olson's testimony.
Great, thank you.
He's not here. And you gave us did you want this entered in?
Sure.
We'll enter the Oregon Department of Human Services cause of injury coding, e-coding page here on the Senate Bill 144.
Mr. Chair, we also have Craig Warden from OHSU here as well, and he'd like to say a few words if there's time.
He'd come forward. Appreciate that. We probably got the record hauled up here of who wanted to speak before you got a chance to sign on, so go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman Fisher and the other members of the committee. I'm Craig Warden. I'm the Chief of Pediatric Emergency Services at OHSU and Dornbecker Children's Hospital. Also a medical toxicologist at the Poison Center and chair of the State Emergency Medical Services for Children Committee. And also an injury prevention researcher. And my particular interest is in trying to do research on trying to prevent pediatric injuries. We've had many problems trying to get a consistent coding when we're looking at hospital charts. And again, without knowing the exact mechanism of injury, we're not going to be able to even start to design prevention programs. So this would certainly help us in our research efforts.
Appreciate that. I apologize. They asked for Joe Bell to come up with them, and her name was below yours, and so I just skipped right on down and didn't see if you were on here. And I apologize.
That's okay.
Okay, we appreciate your testimony here, and I don't know just exactly what we'll proceed on, but I would hope that we could continue maybe to work on this, because we will have some more meetings scheduled, and if we can reach a meeting of the minds here before we get too much farther along, we'll certainly expedite this bill.
Good. Thank you.
You bet.
Good. Thank you.
With that, we will adjourn for the day. And supposedly our final...